We have a rather fascinating subject this morning because it comes very close to all of our lives. And it presents also one of the great conflicts of human thought. Our very remote ancestors depended very largely upon some type of religious tradition to dominate their social relationships. The religious world was the ruling world. And while there were many faiths, most people had something beyond themselves that they regarded as important. They also regarded the universe as more or less the product of a conscious purpose deity, or a principle, or an energy that had real leadership over all created things. Gradually, in more recent times, the emphasis has shifted to science. And today, science is the great opinion maker for the large part of humanity. Science is regarded as a kind of physical god. The sciences are regarded as infallible, far more important than the revelation to Moses on the crest of Sinai. Science, however, in the course of time, like nearly everything else that lives, began to wane as far as its popular acceptances were concerned. The Achilles heel of science became apparent. It became obvious that science could be a very dangerous thing. And just as surely as we gradually outgrew theology because of their dangerous elements, so we are outgrowing science because it is threatening the survival of the human race. We find a strange inconsistency in scientists giving their lives to find cures for things, and at the same time creating the greatest destroyers of all time. So a disillusioned humanity has turned for another leadership. And at this particular time, the leadership that they are mostly dominated by is the leadership of the street and the corner and the drugstore and the shop. The present tradition is largely dominated by a process of personal beliefs and attitudes. The individual feels that he is going to do as he pleases, and that the world is an infinite opportunity and very little responsibility. The new processes of thinking are dangerous also, for from a lack of dominant leadership comes chaos, and chaos ends in crime and ends in all type of private and community vice and difficulty. So we're not very proud of any of these leaders at the moment, but we realize that they have to have a place in things. And we are beginning to come more and more to the realization that our hope rests largely in the religious philosophical area. We are not able to hope that these various materialistic policies are going to endure. They hardly appear before they begin to disappear. Now, if this has some vestige of truth in the thought, then we come to something else. Religious leadership has never, as yet, resulted in a conformity of beliefs. The religious world is not one world. It has one grand concept, but this concept is so broken down by sectarian beliefs that to the average person, religion is now in a state of conflict with itself. And all kinds of beliefs and doctrines are struggling violently to gain dominance over the human life. Religion, therefore, is now mostly sectarianism, with the various sects breaking all the rules of their faith in that regard to each other. So the religious world has a great diversity, but there's one interesting thing about it that I think we all have to consider, that religion very largely deals with matters on which there is no solid basis of common belief. The only power of religion to solve questions and answer the difficulties of life is by a series of hypotheses. religion has to depend upon faith. It has to depend upon acceptance. The individual who rejects it cannot prove why he rejects it. The individual who accepts it cannot prove why he has accepted it. Acceptances and rejections arise largely from personal convictions, antagonisms, or relationships. Out of this, consequently, we have the situation that religion has a wider area of possible solutions to problems than we have generally suspected. If all the religions of the world could get together and combine their common beliefs, we would have certain advantages religiously. There's no question about it. We would find that many religions have items, considerations, specialties that are of importance to us, but which have not been developed in our own faith. Therefore, interreligious understanding can contribute a great deal to the problem of the hour. Now, on the scientific side of this matter, we find a much greater unity. Scientists have a tendency to admire each other almost inordinately. They are very fond of their own research projects, and they're busy as beavers from the time they graduate from the university until they retire, working with some specific situation that entrances them, engages their attention, and dominates their lives. Therefore, the scientist is a dedicated man. But the question is, to what is he dedicated? He is largely dedicated to his own specialization, and he has become a violent and prominent defender of the scientific way of life. To him, this is everything. Now, in order to make science have everything be to appear as he wishes it, he has come into conflict with religion, and in this fight, religion has lost as far as he is concerned. He has placed science as the new religion of all men. Instead of it coming from the prophets in the sky, it comes now from the laboratory and the research groups. And these groups are convinced that they have the answers to everything, and if there are a few points that are not quite settled, they're working on them. They will get them in due time. So that science now considers itself to be the panacea for world ignorance. It also has proved quite an advantage industrially and economically, so that it has become almost the perfect concept of success. It is a success that does not depend upon morality or ethics. Depends entirely upon the use of the human mind to solve the riddles and problems of natural existence. I talked many years ago to a prominent physicist, University of California in Berkeley, about some of their researches in atomics. And I asked him why and how they could do these things without realizing that they were endangering the survival of society. And he was very simple and plain about it. He said, "We are scientists. We find things. We do not use them. We do not tell you how to use them. You handle them. We give you the skills, and you use them as you please. The moral responsibility is with you and not with us." Well, it may have consoled him, but it was a pretty hollow argument, for the reason that when you place a dangerous weapon in a person's hands, you have certain responsibility if that person uses it wrong, because actually you have provided him with the means of destruction. There is responsibility in the revelation of matters which are too dangerous to be suitable for public consideration. But anyway, the scientist has relieved himself, in many instances at least, of all moral and religious responsibilities. He may be personally more or less a religious man. His family may go to church. He may be sending some of his children to parochial schools because he dislikes the present situation in the public school. He has a certain code of his own. As one of them told me, he said, "I am a scientist 6 days a week, and a religionist on Sunday." He doesn't allow, however, Sunday to impose upon any of the other days. So therefore, we find here in science a very high, a skilled, intellectual, mental, experimental form of life, which, however, is without any broad concept of anything beyond physical existence. Therefore, when we come down to the third division, we come into the realm of what might be termed popular opinion. Popular opinion is growing in power all the time. Popular opinion is very largely the individual contemplating his own experiences and deciding what to do next in order to advance his own objectives. This new person can be quite religious, but never allows it to interfere with business. He may be an idealist in parts, but most of all, he is resentful of the policies that run the countries. He is resentful of the waste of resources and energies. He objects to most of the customs and many of the opinions of science. He has not any great sympathy with the political structure. But what does he have in its place? He has only to fall back upon what I think is right, what I believe I can do, or what I am going to do, regardless of whether anyone else likes it or not. So in the midst of this, we observe that we have gradually come to an impasse in which every value of our lives is located and locked upon the physical surface of things. Modern religion thinks in terms of the need for larger institutions, more churches, and higher paid clergy. Science wants more money for laboratories, it wants more research funds, and it is hard at work advancing its own purposes on a physical level. The public in general wants luxury, success, fame, and a good time. Now, all these do not add to very much. In other words, what has the world as a basic form of leadership? How can we control and direct the resources of our world unless we have some kind of a concept of what is necessary and what is next? This seems to be totally lacking. We are more and more in debt all the time. Responsibilities increase, general dissatisfaction changing to terrorism, and still there is no major power to hold the world together. The most successful power that ever attempted it was, of course, religion. It was the only power in the ancient world that permitted even the shadow of civilization to appear. The other forms have been completely localized on a project of one kind or another, and that project has not been basically security for the human being. It has been based largely on the use of this world as an arena for personal profit, advantage, and happiness. So here we are now in the closing decades of the 20th century with a less perspective on life than probably ever before. Here and there voices are raised, but the entire situation is heavily clouded by an all-enveloping materialism, which is leading to war, leading to all kinds of tyrannies, and leading definitely into chaos unless we do something about it. Now, against this, what do we have in real organization? We have only one thing, and that is the good intention of sincere people. Many people see the fact as it is, but not many of them are in a position to do anything important about what they see. They can only hope to regulate their own lives to the degree that they will not be involved in the discrepancies and disadvantages that exist around them. Now, one example of this that we want to take up this morning is a phase of this particular problem. And in this phase, of course, has to do with hereditary factors. The large world heredity, we know, it began with the creation of the planet. And everything upon the planet has inherited something from the beginning of the very planet itself. We are only here because we have inherited from the past everything that we have here. We are here because we have the latest expression of a long-existing search for something. Every generation has had a seeking factor locked in it. The definite effort to know more, learn more, and do more. And we inherit from the past all of our sciences, all of our theologies, our trades, our crafts, our skills, our educational system, our economics, and our industrialism. All of these things have been handed to us as part of a natural heredity. This is just as genuine and just as real as any aspect of heredity applied to the personal development of a family. Actually, therefore, we are the heir to the ages. And we are confronted with a very interesting problem. And that is, the age heredity has gradually failed, or is failing. We are bringing down into the present generation most of the vices of the past, which theoretically we should have begun to correct. We have been handing an unfinished business. And we may say that the small child coming into the world through physical heredity is also handed a world of unfinished business, much of it probably not to be finished by him or in any one generation. We are all inheriting unfinished business. We are inheriting a mess that was bestowed upon us by the thoughtlessness, selfishness, and brutality of the past. We have inherited religious confusion. We have handed a breakdown in our philosophical system. We are now working with a decadent science that is complicating life and solving very little. Some areas are successful. We do not deny that we are also inheriting good things. We are inheriting much that can be of great value to us. But so when we inherit the tools of progress, we are now using these tools very largely to block progress. We have gained a great deal of insight, but the average person is not benefiting from it. We have got more scientific skills than we ever had, but it's becoming prohibitive to pay for one visit to a physician. Everything that we have has been variously, privately turned into profits. And the great problem is that we have inherited a situation in which a vast economic structure that has been here for tens of thousands of years, from the days when we used wampum and cowrie shells down to the present time, it has always been bankrupt. We have been struggling to maintain forever a system that has never worked. But we don't have anything better to use. Now, one of the reasons why systems have never worked is because of all the things we've done and all the thinking we've done, it's been only a few rare persons who have realized that there were rules that had to be followed. And that the reason we are in this miserable mess is because we refuse to accept the rules that would solve the mess. Now, science can't accept rules other than those of the laboratory. It has a certain power to distinguish infinite order, law, and consistency throughout the structure of the universe. Science has to succeed in its experiments because it discovers the laws governing those experiments. Everywhere science turns, it is confronted with laws that cannot be broken. This is accepted on the level of science, but not on any other level. If a person with recognizing the mathematical laws of science starts to apply these to the moral laws of personal life, he will lose his scientific standing. He is not presumed or assumed to have any interest in anything beyond a vast mechanized universe. A universe which is actually one incredible machine. Who invented it, no one dares to ask. Why it was invented in the first place, no one is very sure. The only thing everyone seems to realize is that we are small wheels, cogs, or batteries in a vast organism so great, so stupendous, that we can't even describe it correctly. So we have this problem of the individual and his conflict with laws as they are. Now, we take hereditary conditions as brought about largely through Mendel, and we begin to say to ourselves, what does this all add up to? There is an individual who has a nose a little like father's nose and a disposition that is always analyzed in one way. When the child comes along and develops all of the unpleasant characteristics that may arise, the mother knows they are from the father's family, and the father knows they're from the mother's family. And these delinquencies all together result in the firstborn son. Now, the problem of these things are very interesting. Many people look very much like their parents. There's so much that makes it look as though Mendel was right. Then there is the problem of various indebtedness factors, talents, abilities. Of course, here we have a breakdown on some of it. I have met the children of a number of geniuses, and I assure you the children did not show any symptoms of genius. The son of the great scholar is very apt to turn to some very different procedure from his illustrious forebear. But the physical resemblance is there. And very often, there are peculiarities of appearance, disposition, bodily structure, color of eyes, all these things, and tendencies that look very much as though they were handed down. So we come to heredity with a rather interesting situation. Do we exist as people? Or are we simply the last bundle of our ancestors? Is there any person there at all? Are we partly dependent upon the individual who was hung for piracy in the 15th century, who scalped Indians in the east and western part of the United States, and who probably went to Australia to serve a prison term in the middle 19th century? Who are these ancestors? Are they the highwaymen? Are they the corrupt officers, the decadent aristocrats, and the belligerent clergy of long ago? Who are we? Are we merely the present appearance of a long stream of contributing factors? And what we call a disposition or a temperament is merely an arrangement of dispositional peculiarities from the past. Are we therefore people at all? If I say something, am I really saying it? Or is it something that was said by my great-great-grandfather long ago, and somewhere is locked into the chemistry of my own existence? If I look like an ancestor, and maybe a mixture of several ancestors, and a mixture of several bloodstreams, back as far as you want to go, far further than you can go in heraldry or the genealogical charts of the European aristocrats, who am I? Am I really a person at all? Now, if you carry the Mendel theory far enough, personality breaks down into a combination of former existences and present confusion. Largely, the ultimate picture being somewhat like a cast of the dice. It depends on how things fall, who you are, what you are, and why you are. Now, this seems to be a little inadequate. There must be something about this situation that is more than the individual reliving his ancestry and passing the little more of the same on to his descendants. Are we really people? When I have a temper fit, it's based by because my uncle had a bad disposition. If my morality is not good, is it because I had a relative who was dissipated? These things don't fit together. And the reason they don't fit together is that they combine for the first time a certain sense of relationship between religion and science. The Bible tells us that the sins of the parents shall descend upon the third and fourth generations. And Mandel says almost the same thing. Here we have, therefore, a scientific attitude based upon the Pentateuch and representing the idea or perpetuating the idea in miniature of the grand scheme which has dominated Western theology for over 2,000 years, summed up in the little lyrical statement, "With Adam's fall, we sinned us all." So here we are, the remote descendants of Adam, all bringing to this present generation, generation after generation of corruptions and misdeeds, all the way down. Somewhat from Genghis Khan, something from Alexander the Great, and more recently a little dash of Adolf Hitler. These are the things that we have to think about. Now, science really has no answer to this, except it's regrettable but true. Religion at the present time, as we know it, doesn't have too much to offer either. There will never be a solution to this situation as long as we hold the attitude that heredity is equal to a secondary creation. That heredity is a situation in which from nothing comes something that is the sum of previous miscalculations. Sounds good. Might get a good mark for that on the examination paper. But it still has no answer to what we're looking for. So this brings us our first challenge, and it's something to think about. Is it possible that some source of knowledge on these subjects lies outside of the smug circumference of Western thinking? Is it possible that religion, as we know it, is not the only religion that has any answers for things? And is it also possible that some religions cultivated in other areas by a different type of person with a different background, maybe a different heredity if you want to talk it that way, might have some answers for us? And I think there is an answer. And I know that it will be difficult for some people to accept, but I think we have to bear it in mind. When we are talking about heredity, I think we are saying exactly what Luther Burbank said when he cross-pollinized plants, that he was able to prove conclusively that the strains of these plant colors and forms and structures were unbroken over a vast period of time. And where they appeared to be broken, they were revived again at a later time. By combining red and white roses, Burbank got some red roses, some white roses, and some multicolored roses. After a while, he took another white one from this group, cross-pollinized it again, and got all white ones. He took from these another example and bred it again with an all-white one, and this went on 8 times, in which white remained dominant and the other colors never showed back. On the 9th time, the red came back. It was carried all that time. Now, this is something kind of interesting. Suppose we take now, for this situation, suppose we assume what religion has to give us. Primarily, that we are not merely bodies. We are not monkeys standing on their hind legs. We are not simply physical structures. Birth is not merely the creation of a new life by a physical process. All of the things that we have associated in a materialistic way with the creative and progressive processes are examples relating to only one thing, physical matter. We are dealing with the possibility that in physical matter, Burbank's rose can come back red. In physical terms, we can say that somebody looks like his grandfather. We can find the family traits coming all the time, But every one of these traits is in some way related to body and not to the dweller in the body. We have all of these traits, and we have something that brings them into organization and causes a vitalizing factor to animate a new body. But this is a body. It is a perpetuation of heredity by form only. And by this you can maintain the principles of Mendel and his successors very clearly. But he is only talking about body. Nearly all science is concerned only with body and does not dare to go beyond that. Anything beyond body is merely energy. Anything beyond energy remains unknown. Therefore, what it seems to me our problem is to find a philosophy of life that gives us an understanding that we have a life apart from what we have inherited from the past. That we do not have to make the mistakes of our ancestors, even though we might look like them. Because actually what we are getting by this process of generation is body. Now, if this body does not receive a quickening at the proper time, this body remains comparatively worthless. If the inner life of this body is destroyed, the outer life becomes meaningless. And somewhere in the picture of things, there is an inner life that inhabits the body, but is not identical with it, nor created with it, nor perishes with it. This brings us to one of the most important problems of our thinking. What happens to us when we die? If the materialist is correct, that is the end. And that which was born to suffer, born to learn, to hope, to fear, to love, born to learn something, becomes extinct. Now, science is hard put on that one, but it has come up with something that I think it assumes to be sufficient. Surely, Professor Jones, the great chemist, is no longer existing. He's gone. He's dead. And when it's dead, he's dead completely. There's nothing left of him except what is in a little box in the crematorium. But he has an immortality. He is remembered by his brother scientists. He lives on as a genius, as a great man and a respected man. He lives on also for the consequences of what he did. If he found the cure for yellow fever, that makes him an immortal. And his achievement is eternal and immortal, but the professor himself is stone dead. Now, science seems to feel that this fame factor is the final justification of what man accomplishes in the material world. Of course, even science is looking back, finds that the heroes of one generation are not the heroes of the next. And the scientists of 500 years ago have very little rating here today, except as ancient brethren who did what they could. So the Professor Jones, who's gone forever, sometime becomes one of the ancient brethren who did what he could but made mistakes that the next 10 generations had to correct. So here we are with an individual who is born by an act of generation, who has no existence before birth, except by a chemistry he is going to be a problem of electrical reactions. Then he goes through these tender years of life, failing, gaining, succeeding, hoping, fearing, seeking perhaps to be a better person, wishing desperately to grow and to be worthwhile, and then in due time passing through infirmities and fading away. Now, this is the materialistic attitude of life, which dominates, whether we admit it or not, the larger part of humanity. If they deny it, they still live according to this concept. Their action every day is eat, sleep, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we are going to die. And in death, that's the end of it. Now, to some, the escape from the old idea of perdition, purgatory, Hades, this seems to be a consoling something. It is better to be non-existent than to be punished forever. On the other hand, why should anybody be punished forever? Even assuming that there are some awful rascals in this world, forever is a long time. So the whole theory, as far as it is intellectualized, is very, very unsatisfactory. So we look somewhere else and we have to say the only answer to this is that there must be some difference between the person in the body, as Carl Jung calls him, and the body itself. These two cannot be identical. The creation of the body is not the creation of that which lives in it. The death of the body is not the death of that which lives in it. We can change garments, as we find in the Hindu classic, the Mahabharata. We cast off old garments, but we take new ones. Somewhere in this pattern of things, there seems to be a need to differentiate between the person and the house he lives in. Now, it's true, he may have inherited the house. He may have inherited a palace, a good body. He may have inherited a hovel, a bad body. He may try to build a better one on the property that he already owns, personal improvement. He may waste and neglect the wonderful body that he inherited that was a palace, and as a result of it, it's foreclosed over his head and he is bankrupt. So all kinds of things can happen to bodies. But these things that happen to bodies happen because there is something in those bodies that is, in a sense, separate from them. Someone living in the house. And to build a beautiful house with no one living in it is not good either. If the body is all there is, the whole theory of existence is a dismal failure. And it's a little bit difficult to assume that a creation as splendid, magnificent, and exact as ours is based upon a failure or leads to one. We need to see something else. So looking around the world, we find various peoples. We find, for instance, in Christian religion, there is very little statement as to the condition before birth. The religious group, in the Christian group generally, does not regard a person as existing prior to physical birth. Therefore, he has what my old friend Dr. Bronson called it, he works with a one-ended stick, a stick that has a beginning but no end, something that is created but never terminated. And this doesn't quite work out either. Also, we have to recognize that we've got about 5 billion people on this planet. We've got 5 billion bodies. We're having trouble enough with those. But supposing we tried to understand the 5 million something or other that lives in those bodies, and that this that comes in these bodies comes and goes, leaving bodies, gaining bodies, deserting bodies, but the thing itself remaining alive. So we go to one country and one religion that has made a great deal of this, and that was Hinduism, which gradually, of course, was modified to form Buddhism and Jainism and many other Eastern sects. But the whole concept of Buddhism is based upon the idea that the life in every living thing is eternal. That bodies are beads upon a thread, and that the thread itself runs through all the beads. It is only in this way that a life can be meaningful. If I have only one existence and do not survive that existence, then what are lessons worth? They're nothing. There is no sense in existence unless that which is in the body is separate from it. Lacking this difference, there is no meaning. And yet today, the individual who believes in God and believes this, believes that there is something in that survives, has no realization that this surviving thing has an existence after death that cannot be summarized in the simple statements of heaven and hell. We have to realize that as far as Western theology is concerned, that which is before birth is more or less of a vacuum, and that which is after death is more or less of a bedlam. Nothing works out. The creature is punished forever for something it did not know enough to avoid. A creature underprivileged, poor, and impoverished is penalized forever for stealing a loaf of bread. Their right and wrong take into consideration no factors except the most literal physical interpretation of everything. And these physical interpretations have been dramatized to become theologies. But actually, they are merely a fact that we have to admit, basically, that the answers not being completely available, we must study nature, contemplate upon the processes of existence as we can understand them, and gradually recognize that all these arts and sciences are steps of a ladder that leads up to something we haven't reached yet. When we find it, we are going to find that we are living things in a universe of eternal life, and that all these other problems are man-made, imaginary, or created to enslave human minds. So having come to some such a conclusion as this, for instance, let's assume for the moment that the Buddhist philosophy, which is probably the one most simply explaining these problems, has some integrity in it when it points out that the human being is an eternal creature, and that every human being, saint or sinner, is subject to the same evolutionary process of regeneration and redemption. In Buddhism, there are no lost souls. There are some that are a little sluggish and linger longer than necessary, but there are none that is lost. Therefore, if this is true, the individual comes into birth and remains for a certain number of years and then retires from the physical scene of things. But in retiring, he does not cease. In retiring, he does not go to some ultimate that he cannot understand. He does not go frightened as a slave into the unknown. He goes as he was and as he is, no better, no worse than a human being working toward the improvement of the eternal part of himself. This concept carries with it, however, of course, an opinion that is gaining interest rapidly in the West, but was long regarded as anathema by most Christian sects, and that is reincarnation. Reincarnation is the only solution that is available that prevents the human being from destroying himself. It prevents him from being the subject of universal injustice. It prevents him from ever being able to perform any action that has no meaning. Everything is meaningful. If every day he does the best he can and he tries to improve himself, this improvement goes with him. It does not end in the cemetery. Everything that is real about him goes on. Nothing is lost but the body. Now, that this body may be a perfect image to the Mendelian theory of heredity, we accept. The body could well be a more or less graveyard of ancestors. It could be the repository of all kinds of physical peculiarities, of appearance, of disposition, of physical constitution. It could be the basis of a situation which has two outcomes. If the body is not the person, but the person is in the body, one of two things is going to happen. Either the person is going to dominate the body, or the body is going to dominate the person. If the body takes over to a certain degree, it protects the person. It protects the body, it protects the person from natural disasters or from various situations that are prevented on the bodily level. If, however, the person takes over the body, it then becomes the instrument of self-expression, self-development, and to a very large degree, a revelation of the basic potential of the self in that body.